Welcome into Redacted on this Tuesday, 4th of July. I'm Natalie Morris. I am again flying solo today because Clayton is off for this week and next week. So next week you'll have just me again. And then the week after that, if he returns from the moon, he will join us again. You are in good hands. Thank you for joining me yesterday for my solo flight. But I'm not solo. I have David in the control booth and Philip. Boys, if you'd like to say hello, say hello.
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 We need to do the hello, hello.
Hello. Hello. Hi, everybody.
Well, there's only two of us, so we can only do the first third, but you know.
Yeah, I have three children, so a lot of times when we're walking around someplace, I'll go, sound off, mommy. And they go, sound off, Miles, so I know they're all there. So we also can sound off. That's Grover the dog. He's sounding off. Thank you for working today, you guys, on the holiday on 4th of July. I didn't even ask if you wanted to work.
My alternative is just to play video games with my younger brother. So,
okay. You
know, I'll do that afterwards.
Okay, good.
That's what I had going on today.
All right.
And David, all I'm doing is protecting dogs' ears from fireworks that have been going off since Thursday.
Oh, yeah. Poor thing.
So we have a bunch of scared dogs running around. Yeah.
That's rough. Yeah, that's rough. Well, whatever this holiday means to you, if you're in the United States, hopefully we can all set our intentions on living in a free society. How about that? That's our commonality, wherever you live, because that is not a foregone conclusion any longer, as seems to be the theme of our show. But nevertheless, here we go. So today on Redacted, we haven't even got to the intro. I meant to. We just got carried away. Today we're going to talk about drone strikes in Israel. Between Israel and Palestine. And this is a topic we haven't really touched on before, but violence is ratcheting up and we felt like we needed to. We are going to continue to talk about the riots in France and how the mainstream media seems to be shaping the conversation about Middle Eastern people in a way that does not include them. Because why do that? We're going to talk about men who breastfeed, how they do this, what the concerns are, many. And our own Dan Cohen has spoken to a lawyer who is suing the CIA and Mike Pompeo for tapping into their phones and spying on their meetings with Julian Assange. This case could be a linchpin around the entire U.S. case against Julian Assange. And we're going to take a look at that interview as well. All of that as Redacted starts right now. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us on this holiday. If you are celebrating, if you're not, we're here. We're working. There are things to take a look at, and we're going to take a look at those things. So I'm working. Clayton's not, but I appreciate you being here. And we're going to get to all of the stories I mentioned at the top of the show. I should mention you can continue to follow along with these stories and more at our newsletter. It's redacted.inc. This is a free subscription. All you have to do is put in your email address and then click submit. And we will not ask you for anything other than to authenticate that email. And then we send you daily news updates about the same types of topics we cover on this show, geopolitical news. I'm pretty militant about making sure that you have links. Every now and again, I look back at the newsletter. I'm like, there's a link missing there because I want you to read and digest for yourself. I don't want you to swallow any kind of narrative that we may have landed upon, because we are all free thinkers here. And I love your comments when you say, yes, I agree with you with this, or maybe you don't, you know, have this right. I appreciate your emails and your comments very much. So this is a conversation. It's also a place where we tell you when we're going to have a show and when we're not, when we're going to be live and when we're not. So this comes to you every day that the show is live, Monday through Thursday. It should be there in the morning Eastern time. So again, you can subscribe for free at redacted.inc. Again, this is our daily newsletter accompaniment to this show, and you can get it again at redacted.inc. Well, Israel is using major firepower against the Palestinian people living in the West Bank And the U.S. says that they support this as a defensive move. Over 20 drone strikes have rained down on a refugee camp called Jenin since Monday, and at least 8 people have been killed, some of them children. Palestinian authorities say this is the worst attack on the city since 2002. Now, many people have been asking us to cover this story. This is something we don't touch on a lot because of the highly sensitive nature of Israel and Palestine. I want to admit I'm scared to touch it many times because I want to be sensitive. And so I've invited a guest on because as soon as civilians are getting hurt, you have to touch it, whether you're scared or not. So we're going to do it. Here we go. My guest today is a Palestinian and American journalist, Ramzi Barood. He has been warning about the armed revolt before this renewed conflict. So thank you so much for joining me today and offering your perspective.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Now, Israel says that they are acting defensively. Can you explain what they mean and what triggered this renewed round of firepower?
Well, in theory, Israel cannot act defensively because under international law, and this is why we really shouldn't be scared of touching this issue, because we are looking here at a very clear set of international laws and resolutions regarding what's happening in Palestine and Israel. Palestine is an occupied territory. Israel is the occupying power. According to the 4th Geneva Convention and many other UN resolutions, Israel is responsible for the welfare of the occupied Palestinian until the issue of occupation is resolved. Military occupation under international law is not supposed to be a permanent process. It's a temporary process, not in the case of Palestine and Israel. Palestine has been under Israeli occupation for over 50 years, specifically since 1967, and the roots of the issue goes back to 1948. Mm-hmm. So when Israel invades a place like Jenin, most of the residents of that place are refugees who should be protected under international law. It's immediately you have a major and stark violation of international law. What Israel is saying is that it's defensive in the sense that, well, Palestinians are resisting. Well, what do you expect from an occupied nation, whether in Ukraine, in Palestine, anywhere in the world, when people are under military occupation, they have to resist. You and I and others might agree or disagree on the nature and the type of resistance that should or should not be permissible from a moral or even legal point of view. But that's a different issue. Resistance is enshrined in international law as well. Israel doesn't want to see itself as an occupying power. It contests the very idea that it's doing anything in violation of international law. Sadly, Washington more or less agrees with the Israeli perspective. Yes, the Biden administration recognizes Israel's occupation and wants the Israelis to stop building illegal settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem, but they are kind of giving them their blind and unconditional support, justifying what's happening in Jenin at the moment as part of Israel's security need, Israel's right to defend itself, so forth and so on. We have seen this language repeated in the past, not just in the case of Jenin, but also in the case of Gaza as well throughout the years.
Well, one of the reasons that this is scary is because a lot of times if someone says, well, Israel should not be defending itself, which you pointed out the flaw in that statement, then that is called anti-Semitic. It seems a way to stop the conversation so that you can't have it. But the idea of defending itself is also not a unified concept. For instance, Ukraine can do it, but Syria can't, right? I can make many parallels like that. So let's put aside the idea of defending itself and talk about the idea of anti-Semitism. Can you touch on that?
Right. So this is a powerful approach that the Israeli, what we call Israeli Hasbara, which is the version, the unique version of what we call propaganda elsewhere in the world, that any criticism of Israel is a form of anti-Semitism. And the thing about this argument, I mean, it's full of holes. To begin with, Arabs are actually Semitic people. So to say anti-Semitism, while Arabs and Palestinians are Semitic people, I am Semitic, my parents are Semitics, and our history and roots in, you know, as Semitic people go back in Palestine hundreds if not thousands of years. So for us to be completely marginalized from the whole Semitism thing doesn't really make any sense. But it works very well in the West. I've traveled many countries, over 50 countries around the world, in the global south and in the global north, and I've rarely come across that argument in South America, in Africa, in the Middle East, or in Asia. It's usually something that they infuse for obvious historical reasons in Europe and in the United States. And sadly, quite often it works. It's a conversation ender. You're no longer talking about Netanyahu, the right-wing government, his right-wing, far-right ministers who are saying these horrible genocidal statements, calling for a religious war against Palestinians and so forth. This is no longer the conversation. It puts you immediately on the defensive. Are you Semitic? Are you anti-Semitic or not? And that is a clever way of shifting from the conversation at hand. The good thing is that there are more people who have been accused of anti-Semitism than not, to the point that it's the argument itself is becoming weaker. Many wonderful, great Jewish anti-Zionist Jewish scholars, the likes of Noam Chomsky, the likes of Richard Falk, and a huge list of progressive anti-Zionist and pro-Palestine intellectuals from all sorts of religious or ethnic or national backgrounds have been accused of anti-Semitism, to the point it is rarely effective compared to what it used to be in the past. And I, in my opinion, the more we speak out, the weaker the argument becomes over the years. The point here is focus on what is happening in Jenin, in Palestine, as far as the occupation is concerned, and walk away from trying to constantly defend ourselves, because the moment we engage in self-defense, the moment the argument is lost.
Right, and even Jewish people like Natalie Portman has spoken out about on behalf of the Palestinian people, and she, you know, can't be called anti-Semitic. But I think, you know, I'm less interested in blaming names or groups than looking at, you know, civilians being hurt. Now, you wrote in this piece that Jenin has been always a resistant camp. So what kind of resistance happens there?
Okay, so there are various types of resistance that exist when a nation is under occupation. Quite often, in the case of Palestine, we distinguish between two types of resistance that I disagree with both. One is what is being called peaceful resistance as opposed to violent resistance. I don't think resistance in a national paradigm works that way. There is no such thing as peaceful, and there's no such thing as violent. There's something called popular resistance or everything else. Popular resistance is when people resist as a reflection of a greater collective phenomenon. And they express that resistance in numerous forms. Cultural resistance, for example, the Jenin refugee camp has been affiliated with the Freedom Theater. The Freedom Theater has produced some of the best actors and the best artists in Palestine, and it has been a hub of Palestinian cultural resistance. For example, now it's being bombed by the Israelis as we speak. So it's not just the matter of are they using arms or aren't they using arms. I think the type of resistance that Palestinians employed, and in this case they are using armed resistance, is a reflection of the degree of violence that is being meted out by the Israelis. The more violent you are against a human being in any social or political context, the more violent the response is going to be. It's just a human nature. It's as simple as that. And the Palestinians of Jenin have been treated very badly, not just today or yesterday, but for decades. They have been marginalized. They have been alienated. They have been isolated. They have been constantly attacked. They are under constant Israeli military siege. Their land is being lost in a large degree because of the growing illegal Israeli colonial settlements in that area. So as a result, they have been resisting in various forms throughout the years. And the culmination now to armed resistance is very much related to the intensity of the Israeli violence, airstrikes and constant assassinations that takes place in that refugee camp.
Right. And Israel has a lot of firepower, much of it from the United States. And so we're not talking about an apples to apples type of fight. And it almost, at this point, does it matter? Can we peel back to the first bullet? It doesn't matter once civilians are being harmed, and this is no longer just a military conflict, right? And so we see many times ceasefire and then it's back, and then ceasefire and then it's back. So when does that bleed over into civilian strikes on either side, and then how does that stop?
That's an excellent point. Quite often we speak about the ceasefire, or in the case of Gaza, we speak about truce. But rarely do we actually discuss the roots of all of this. Why are we even engaged in that violence in the first place? Why is there Palestinian resistance? Why would any people resist if there was no need for them to resist?
And I just want to point out that you wrote here that Palestinian authorities don't want this either. So it's not like there is, nobody here is speaking for violence. And I want to make sure that that's clear from your voice. And I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, absolutely. It's so the question is not, we're not dealing with a moral argument or a philosophical argument concerning violence. We are dealing what leads to violence in the first place. If you have military occupation, naturally you are going to have resistance, and the resistance manifests itself in various ways, including violence. So truce, ceasefire is going to bring a temporary end to particular hostilities taking place within a particular time frame, but will not address the root issues that have took us this far.
Yeah.
In order for the violence in Jenin to permanently end, there has got to be some sort of a political horizon. There has got to be an end to the occupation. There's got to be a cease to the constant settlements that are being built on Palestinian land. Once that is the case, then there is no need for Palestinian resistance. We can talk about Palestinian development, Palestinian economic growth. There's no need for Palestinian resistance in the first place. And that's why ceasefires don't end this situation, but it rather gives some sort of a respite from it. And we keep going back to the original issue, and that is military occupation.
Okay, so thank you for that. I really appreciate your perspective on that. So what happens now, do you think, for the rest of this week? And maybe for the rest of this year. I'll end it with this.
Absolutely. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is desperate to leave Jenin with any kind of victory, so he can sell it back to his right-wing constituency as saying, we have won, they have lost, you wanted me to go to major war against the West Bank. No need for that. I managed to pacify the resistance in Jenin. I don't think this is going to work, because if this approach would have worked, it would have worked in 2002 when there was that major battle and the major massacre in Jenin. It will not work in the future, especially that the capabilities of Palestinian resistance have grown exponentially in recent years, and because Gaza is stronger than ever, and because there's a growing sense of Palestinian unity that is unprecedented in modern history. So I really do think that this is just a temporary battle. Perhaps a much bigger one will happen in the future. For the time being, there will be some politicking around the idea that we have won and the Palestinians have been destroyed for good.
Well, it seems like such a big ask to get to a peaceful agreement. And we saw this in France this week. It's an important question. How do two cultures live together in proximity in a way that works for everybody? And it's something the entire world seems to be dealing with, and I'm sorry we had to, discuss it around this idea of violence. But again, I appreciate your take. Our guest today has been Ramzi Barood, and you can find his work on, I'm sorry, can you repeat the name of your outlet?
Yes, of course. So I run the PalestineChronicle.com. It's one of the main Palestinian English, French, and Italian news portals on Palestine.
Okay, thank you again for your time today.
Of course, my pleasure.
Now, the U.S. has said that they believe that Israel has the right to defend themselves. They are sending billions in arms to Israel, and they will continue to do so annually. And this is something that we even saw shoved into COVID relief bills. So you can see where the priorities lie in the West. And I appreciate your comments in the chat during that interview. They were productive, and I think we have the smartest audience around, and I appreciate that. No one seemed to want to get upset about this and then attack personally. And I appreciate, because, like I said, this is a touchy subject, and I was nervous to take it on. David, do you have any thoughts?
Give it time, somebody. Give it time,
okay.
Somebody will get
you want
off.
To be the first shitty comment. Then you can say first in the chat.
I just think it's a shame that, like I said earlier when we were talking about it before the show, is that people pick a side with this issue, and there's no give.
Yeah.
You know, once you've picked a side. And I think that's a dangerous position to be in.
Right. This is a dangerous position to be in general. It's just a really touchy one. And, you know, I think that what we can all want is peaceful coexistence. And the fact that we don't have it right now is, you know, the images that we showed are shocking of this war zone. And this is where people live. So, yeah, no, nobody's saying first with a shitty personal comment. So, okay, we can all be adults. That's amazing. Okay. Hooray. Well, we're going to move on and we're going to talk about, we have a lot to talk about when it comes to the riots in France, how the media is telling you what to think about Muslim people and what Muslim people think. So they're telling you both what you should think about Middle Eastern and Muslim people and what they think without actually involving anybody who is Middle Eastern or Muslim in this conversation. Run along, little child. That's sort of how the media is doing it. Wait till you see Jen Psaki's take on what Muslim people are being manipulated to behave like. This is some crazy stuff. Talk about, you know, one of the things that I really think about a lot when it comes to presenting the show or presenting the newsletter is, am I speaking for somebody I should not be speaking for? Am I presenting something and missing somebody's viewpoint? This is something I obsess over because I never want to speak for people or for certain groups, only just to sort of present various takes on things. And so I don't think MSNBC has anybody reflecting on that. It seems, and especially not Jen Psaki. We're also going to talk about a biological man who has a few of them, actually, who've taken it upon themselves to pump themselves full of hormones and then do what they're calling breastfeeding. I am an experienced breastfeeder. I have a lot to say about this, a lot. And we're going to talk about whether or not this is experimentation on newborn babies. It is. I'm not going to bury the lead there. And then we're going to talk to a lawyer. Dan Cohen has an interview that he's going to bring us with a lawyer of Julian Assange, who is suing the CIA and Mike Pompeo for saying that they stole data from their devices and spied on them. This could be the linchpin that crumbles the Julian Assange case. If governments were working as if they are supposed to be, it would. But around Assange, we've seen that they don't. So we'll see what happens, and I'd love your take on this interview. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at Private Internet Access, because have you ever tried to watch something that was from another country and you couldn't watch it? I myself am very into Korean Netflix shows, not Squid Games, because I'm a little whiny baby. But I really liked, for instance, The Extraordinary Attorney Woo. If anybody's seen that, it's wonderful. It's just a feel good. It's something that I need after covering the topics that we cover. You know, and I need a VPN to do that, because a lot of times you need to fling yourself into another location in order to do that. Boys, do you like any far-flung TV or programming that you can't watch without
it? I don't really watch anything.
Yeah.
I don't really watch anything.
We don't watch TV really.
Okay, any websites you like to go to? For instance, we know that Rumble is blocked in France unless you use a VPN.
I do use my VPN when we're doing certain stories, because there's some like footage that I can get from the Russian state media that
yes.
you can't get anywhere else, and I can't access it ordinarily.
Interesting, right? That's interesting. Well, that's why our sponsor today is a bit of a departure from this, because it helps, you know, everyone to get the products that they want on the internet. Did you know that over 30 million people have signed up for Private Internet Access? All you have to do is connect to a server and you're all good to go. It's really Private Internet Access that offers fast servers in over 80 countries, plus every user U.S. state. Plus, the VPN is very user-friendly. There are apps available for all devices, smart TVs included, and one subscription can be used to protect for an unlimited amount of devices at the same time. So, we want to tell you how to explore this option and get Private Internet Access. Right now, you can subscribe by heading over to piavpn.com PIAVPN.com/redacted. That's PIAVPN.com/redacted and get an 83% discount. So that's just $2.03 a month. Plus you get an extra 4 months completely free, but you must go to this website, PIAVPN.com/redacted for a truly private digital life. Just one more time, I'll repeat it. PIAVPN.com/redacted. With the riots in France, the West is trying to shape how we feel about Middle Eastern people in very different ways. Now, in France, we're told that Middle Eastern people and Muslims in general are powerless and abused and left to rot in society and mistreated, and thus we have these violent riots. Now, in the U.S., we're being told that the GOP is weaponizing Muslims against the transgender community as if they have no agency of thought of their own. This piece from former White House spokesperson Jen Psaki left me nearly speechless.
And the right wing has focused their fear-mongering on trans people. And who better to go after the new enemy than the old enemy? Consider this from 2015.
We cannot be the warehouse of all these, you know, Muslim people coming from these far-flung lands where we're just not going to be able to control who becomes radicalized, who doesn't, because of technology. It's impossible.
Now, if you can believe it, Laura Ingraham is rallying Muslims against books in schools with LGBTQ plus themes.
Us Catholics and other Christians, other people of faith have been waiting for the Muslims to step up on this issue.
In an interview later with Semaphore, Laura Ingraham's guest, who you just saw on the screen, couldn't believe how ironic this all is. He said, quote, 5 years ago, Laura was saying we shouldn't have Muslims in this country. Now she's saying, thank God the Muslims are here. Just to summarize, the right-wingers, the conspiracy theorists, the birthers, they now want us to forget the years they spent fear-mongering about Muslims and Islam. 10 years ago, standing against Sharia law was the key GOP litmus test. Now that litmus test seems to be how fervently you oppose transgender people. Just listen to what Trump himself had to say about that. Even he doesn't exactly know why he's attacking them.
It's amazing how strongly people feel about that. You see, I'm talking about cutting taxes. People go like that. Talk about transgender. Everyone goes crazy. Who would have thought 5 years ago you didn't know what the hell it was?
So what you just heard in that video, that sounds an awful lot like and reminiscent of what George Wallace, a staunch segregationist, once told a newspaper editor. Quote, you know, I tried to talk about good roads and good schools and all of these things that have been part of my career and nobody listened. And then I began talking about black people and they stomped the floor. So let's be clear. This is the same old GOP playbook, another cynical ploy to tear at the fabric of our society and damage the idea that out of many, we are one, all because they want so desperately to regain the White House.
So in other words, she's saying Muslims can't think for themselves. If you hear them say that they are not supporters of the transgender agenda, they don't mean it. That's just the GOP speaking for them. Here to discuss this propaganda and speak for himself is journalist Kavork Almasian, who is an immigrant from Syria living in Europe. So you have a good perspective about how people from the Middle East are conceived of, how this conversation is shaped for them and not directly from them. First of all, let's talk about the riots, because you spoke out about the French riots, condemning them, but then pointing to the fact that this mass migration is a result of the destruction of these communities. Can you explain that?
First of all, nothing in my opinion justifies vandalizing public and private properties. I would be very honest that I wouldn't like to see my cities and my country burning down like it's happening in France. We have a firsthand experience in Syria how such rioters can abuse the people's demands on the ground. There are so many people who have legitimate demands from the French government, but when you riot and loot and destroy public properties, in my opinion, it's also private properties. properties, you wouldn't really giving the right impression. Now, there are from any community that could come to Europe, there are always good apples and bad apples, right? But when during such times, we don't see the good apples coming to the streets and trying to calm down the people because it's a very dangerous place. And therefore, we see always the bad apples coming to the streets. And this is something we have to address carefully because when you have an open door policy for migration or for refugees to come to your country, we have to know that among them, there will be also people who are not really interested to live peacefully in Western societies because their values contradict the values of the West in general, let's say. So when you speak about these issues and when you say, yeah, in our countries, we have also very good people, they can come in Europe or in the United States and they can integrate, but there are also some people that we have to be a little bit careful of, right? But when you say these things, you're categorically and very quickly accused of being a fascist, you're accused of being a self-hating Syrian or self-hating Middle Eastern, etc., etc., etc. I myself, I'm Middle Eastern. I'm a secular person. I believe that all religions and sects should be treated equally. But some communities, in my opinion, they want to have their special status when they come in the Western societies. And that is who's helping this process of creating, for example, ghettos in Western society, Western countries, are the radical left. The radical left says, for example, in Germany, kein Mensch ist illegal, which means no person is illegal. So anyone could come to Germany, anyone can bring himself to Germany and come. And my point is, everyone who is eligible to come to Germany, if he's running away from a war, then he's a refugee. He can apply for an asylum, right, if he proves his case. And if he's an economic migrant and he has some sort of skills who can bring something with him, then those are very legitimate cases. People can do this stuff, right? But at the same time, why not checking the background of the people before they arrive here? I'm in Germany for 8 years now, and I, with my own eyes, personally, I've seen people who were fighters in Syria among the Islamist militants, and they're now walking here in the streets freely. They're getting loans from the banks or living on the taxpayer money of the people who work in Germany, and they're creating troubles. But when you point your finger to these people who are, in my opinion, they're a minority, but they are loud and they can cause troubles, right? Mm-hmm. And when you say that we have to isolate these people or probably check their background with the Syrian government before they arrive here, you are attacked by the media.
Oh, it's human rights abuse, right?
Yeah, exactly. So even you are not allowed to ask for the deportation of these people from Germany because they say if we cannot send them to Syria because Assad will torture them. This is the official narrative. But that doesn't make any sense for the people living here because if there are, let's say, 10 refugees and one of them commits a horrible, heinous act and you don't punish these people in the correct way, then the Germans or the local communities here, they do reaction against such acts. If this person is punished, for example, a rapist, how is it possible that the person who rapes a woman here in Germany who comes from, let's say, an outside country can only receive 5 years in jail? And we know that there was a gang rape of this woman. This woman's life is over. So it doesn't make sense, in my opinion, also the laws and regulations that are applying on the people is also encouraging such theft or such activities in this community. So in my opinion, there should be tougher background checks and also very importantly to impose the harshest punishment on the people who refuse to act in a civil way. And I'm very careful about this case because I've been already attacked by the German media multiple times for stating these obvious things. But it's very important to isolate the radicals among the good people who are coming from the Middle East, North Africa, from everywhere, right? Because in Germany now we have the number one doctors in Germany. Like we have the Germans, they have the highest number of doctors. The second highest number of doctors are from Syria. And they're all working and they're having, they're around 8,000 doctors. So we have so many good people in Syria that can also, we can speak about them. But in this particular case, it's important to really touch the root of the causes, the problem. So there are, of course, radical people living in Germany and they pretend to be refugees or they receive asylum here.
I think that this leftist narrative assumes that when we say people should be punished for crimes, we are saying their lives are worth less than other people's lives because of their skin color. And my philosophy is that everyone else's life is worth what my life is worth. And so therefore, equal justice under the law is equal. So what we're saying is that if you're a victim of someone of a certain color, we can't speak down about them because otherwise we are assuming that they're worth less than us. It's a complete point system about who's worth what and versus...
Because this radical left...
Yeah.
Because this radical left sees things in as clans, as tribes. They see you only skin color. They see you only because they divide the communities into vertical lines. And therefore, when they do that, they create, they want to use this in electoral successes. Because if they say that that Muslims are one community, one color, one shape, one opinion, they can try to manipulate them as one community to vote for their political parties. And you can see this clearly.
Which is what we just saw Jen Psaki do on MSNBC, saying, you Muslim people, you absolutely don't believe in gender critical philosophy. You want to be accepting to transgender people, but the GOP is telling you you're not, which is a complete denigration of an entire people's belief system and saying you don't understand your own beliefs.
Because first of all, Jen Psaki, she doesn't know anything about the Muslim communities as a community, and also she doesn't understand the religion. In my opinion, in Western societies, Christianity has been put on the shelf, right? I understand that. But in among the Muslims, religion plays a very important role. It's a way of life. It's not only a religion that can organize the individual affairs, but also communal affairs and also the affairs of the community with the state. It's a religion of a state and a religion of yourself as an individual. And in Islam, for example, this gender identity or whatever they're trying to choke us with their own ideology is forbidden. And it's not something that they can change it. There is no window for Islam to change its texts. So therefore, the Muslim communities will follow what is written in the text. And in the text, this philosophy that the radical left is trying to shove our throats every day, it's against their beliefs. Therefore, when she is trying to say that the GOP or the conservatives or the Republicans are trying to manipulate the Muslim community, she doesn't understand at all that this is becoming a natural alliance now between the Muslim communities and the conservatives, because at the beginning, nobody cares. If you, whatever is your sexuality, whatever you're doing in your home or in your private times, nobody cares if you're a Muslim or Christian or any religion. If you belong to any religion, who cares what you do at your private times? But when you go to the street and you're naked, and you're bringing kids, and you're doing drag shows, and you're telling children 3, 4, 5 years old that maybe you're not a maybe you're not a girl, maybe you're not a boy, and they're indoctrinating them, including here. We have now the first LGBTQ plus kindergarten in Germany. So people start to thinking like, no, this is too much. You're really crossing the boundaries now, and if we don't stand to any boundaries, then we'll stand for nothing.
Right.
And kids are red line for them, right? Don't come to our kids. Do whatever you want, but don't come for our kids. And I think that's the red line that the Muslims have drawn. And I think the conservatives have come as a natural allies for them, because there is no other people who are standing against them. And rest assured, if there is a necessity for to go to school boards, speak with the teachers and protest, real protesting, it's the Middle Eastern community, whether they are Christian or they are Muslims, they are the ones who are going to oppose this attempt, I would say, to sexualize the kids, which is, in my opinion, very ridiculous.
But the left will take any opportunity to tell minority groups that they are their advocates. It doesn't matter who they are, right?
But they don't tell them that they have become refugees, and also they have become refugees or migrants in these countries because of their policies in the Middle Eastern and North African countries. When these people arrive in Germany or in the United States, they embrace them. They try to tell them that we are tolerant, and they give them job opportunities or scholarships, etc., etc. But nobody says that these people on the left here in Germany, for example, they're the ones imposing sanctions on many Middle Eastern countries.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And they're creating this economic misery that the people are trying to flee from their own
right.
countries.
We stand for you here, but your relatives back in Syria who can't get antibiotics, we don't stand for them.
Let them vote.
Yeah.
Let them vote.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe, just maybe, this is a way for different communities to understand their common values rather than their differences. If we have an alignment with the Christian community and the Muslim community, and also non-secular people like yourself that say that kids are a tripwire, this is a red line. Yeah. We support family values and also the innocence of children. So this is a conversation that would cost a lot of people a lot of power, don't you think?
Yeah, we have to draw a line, in my opinion. This is very, very important. Otherwise, they will try to push further. Every time you accept a new, let's say, an ideology or a new gender that they create every day, they will come something more crazy the second day. As long as you don't set up the red line, they're going to come and push it further and further and further. So it's very important to draw the line now. Secondly, when you draw a line and when you create natural alliances between different people, regardless of their religion, sect, and ethnicity, you are already destroying the attempt of the radical left, and I'm very specific because there are so many good left parties and left-wing people, but the radical left that is trying to create a zombie society, which is based on vertical lines that they consider Latinos as one block, the Muslims as one block, and the Africans as one block, and then deal with them as one static community. Mm-hmm. And when you break that, and when you create natural alliances between these people, regardless of their sect and religion, an entire process in the past 2 to 3 decades, you already broke that, destroyed that that process that the radical left was trying to implement and enforce on the people. So this is very dangerous for the radical left, such as Jen Psaki, that she was I watched the video, and to be honest with you, it's very clear that she doesn't know anything about the Muslim community. I'm not sure if she has any Muslim friends. Maybe if she has, they are very liberal like her, but most of the Muslim communities and Middle Eastern communities are very conservative, and they want to preserve their family values. They want to preserve their authority on their kids. Your kids are your kids, not the state's kids. Because remember what Joe Biden said at the beginning of June during the Pride month,
oh, yes,
when he was talking about the trans kids, and he said, "We support you. You are our children." What does it mean we are our children? They are trying now to tell you that you as a parent, you don't have a say over your children. And if you disagree with our ideology, and it's coming, they're going to legalize and they're going to impose new laws and regulations. And they will say you're not fit to become a parent, and they will take your children from you if you don't accept their way of life. I'm from Middle East. I was born as a Christian. I want to have a children, and I'm terrified in this society, because if I want to have a children in this society, and if they're going to indoctrinate my kid in the school, and then I will lose my children, that's, it drives you, you lose your sanity, because that's it because the most valuable thing any person could have is his and her children. And if they can take over your children by hijacking their brain and turning them against their parents, and that's the end, in my opinion, for any healthy society.
This is something I deal with a lot when my children go, say, to a camp or a school trip, and the you know, booklet that they send say children will be separated by gender. I'm like, can we clarify what we mean by gender? That it's biological sex? Because I'm very concerned that my daughter is in a room with children. These kind of things are absolutely haunting when it comes to being a parent at this point. So thank you for offering your perspective on this moment, because again, I feel like a lot of the Western talking points are around talking down to people from the Middle East or talking for them. And I would never want to do that. So thank you for offering your perspective as always. It was fantastic.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Well, thank you for your comments on that segment. That
he is my favorite person that we have on this show.
He's one of our, most requested guests, and people really respond well to them, to him. And I love it. I'm glad for that too, because it offers a different perspective when someone can, give a perspective that's not speaking for Middle Eastern people, not speaking about them. I grew up in Fremont, California, where there's a large Afghan population. And I know that, you're not even really supposed to ride in cars with boys in some of those, communities. Like, they have different interpretations of mixed gender. And it's not for me to say how they behave, whether that's right or wrong. So it's interesting for the right to say, well, that's being weaponized. They don't actually feel that way. Absolutely, they do. Do you want to say something, David?
Yeah. He's drinking water. I was going to chime in. What I really appreciate about when we have Kevork on is, like, he's somebody that, whether I agree with him or not, you know where he stands. And I just absolutely appreciate that out of anybody.
Yeah.
It's just like where there's no question. He's like very eloquent about how he's like, this is exactly what I think.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate that out of him.
Me too. I wonder what he talks about when he says he's taken on by the German media. It's probably good that I don't read German. A lot of times, when something gets too heated, I need to block it. Just sort of block it out from my peripheral vision. Even heated arguments on Twitter, I can't. The things we deal with on this show, they're too energetically big. And I can stay up at night just being scared, or should we talk about this, or should we touch it? And we just keep, but a lot of times I need to isolate myself from it. So probably good that I don't read German. So anyhow, well, the next topic is going to set my hair on fire. So get ready for that. So we're going to talk about whether or not men should be breastfeeding, because many of them are. It's just what they're doing now. And then we're going to talk about a lawyer for Julian Assange, who is suing the CIA and Mike Pompeo, the former head of the CIA, for spying on them while they were setting their legal defense with their client, Julian Assange. Is this something that the American case can now crumble because of? Or is it something that will be manipulated for political gain? Again, the case against Julian Assange keeps marching forward. He does seem to be facing extradition. And I've been reading a book by a man called Nils something. I'll have to find the title, about the case against Julian Assange. He is a UN special rapporteur who has been going to four different governments, the UK, Sweden, Ecuador, and the United States, and detailing all of the human rights violations about Julian Assange, starting with his sexual abuse case and all the way through, and how just these governments seem to just do whatever they please, even though there is a protocol for how to treat somebody like this. You are not supposed to be able to extradite for espionage, because that is an obvious politically motivated extradition. But they are anyway. David, were you going to say something?
I was going to say something.
Nils Melzer. Melzer.
Yes. Melzer. Thank you.
Yeah.
Philip.
Oh, and I was going to say, this way, I'm interested in this story, because that they're going to extradite him no matter what, because of the sunk cost fallacy. Like, the U.S. has put too much into this to not do it. So they don't give a damn about the rules, what the laws are. They're going to do it. I mean, that's just guaranteed. He's going to get extradited to the United States, because they won't let it not happen.
Yeah. There's too much face to save here. And so that's why the rules are just completely bent from the get-go. Even just the part about the sexual abuse allegations, they're really complicated. The women who reported it, they didn't want to report the R word that sometimes gets us canceled on certain platforms, so I won't say it, grape without a G. They went in specifically to use the police to force him to take an HIV test because they had both willingly had sexual relations with him. They neither of them had considered it that. The narrative was taken from them, and they then never got their HIV test, which was their original thing that they were both freaking out about together. They had sort of teamed up. So, you know, the government had compromised his civil rights in the investigation all manner of ways, and they compromised theirs. They were supposed to be left nameless. They were, you know, the narrative was completely stolen from them. And there are text messages between the two of them saying they've arrested him. What? They're saying, you know, this, what? This has been manipulated from the get-go. Even the pictures of him leaving the Ecuadorian embassy, looking all crazed. Someone had specifically stolen his shaving kit weeks before. So in advance, in preparation for those photos, knowing that he would be pulled out of there and wanting him to look extra crazy. I mean, that in and itself may not seem like a huge human rights violation, but he has been the target of a lot of the worst of it, the worst that nefarious powers can throw at you, he has received. So anyway, we're not going to talk more about Julian Assange until later. I jumped the gun. We're going to talk about men breastfeeding first. But first, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor, Bird Dogs, because Bird Dogs are here to make you look good this summer. Bird Dogs are stretch khaki shorts that are designed to fit slimmer through the thigh and leg and give you this truly sculpted look. They're khaki shorts designed to fit you and fit like khaki shorts, but they are ready for whatever fun things you're going to do this summer. They fit way better than regular shorts that are made of stiff, restricting cotton. Bird Dogs fix this issue by inventing cloud knit fabric that looks like khaki, but stretches so you get this slimmer fit without having to sacrifice on movement. Plus, it uses this sweat wicking fabric that keeps you cool and dry all day long. Just last week, I dragged Clayton along to this 8K race that he didn't want to go to. And he was like, well, we're going to go to dinner first. And I'm like, well, we're not going to go to dinner dressed in our workout clothes. So he needed shorts that looked nice enough to go to dinner and then also do a race in. So this is perfect for that kind of thing. You know, when I was younger, I thought like going from day to night would be a bigger deal. But you know, we're all adults. We have commitments. So if this is what you'd like to do, live an active life, but also look stylish for things like that, when your wife drives you to a foot race that you don't want to do, this is the wardrobe for you. So you can now go to birddogs.com/redacted and enter promo code redacted for a free Yeti style tumbler with your order. Who doesn't want that? That's birddogs.com/redacted, or use our promo code redacted for your purchase plus a free Yeti style tumbler. You won't want to take your Bird Dogs off, we promise you. All right. Well, a biological man has successfully breastfed an adopted child. This is a trans-identified man who says that he's a woman, and was able to take a cocktail of hormone therapy in preparation to feed an adopted baby, according to this case report. Now, this report goes through what they were able to do. This person presented themselves to a doctor's office and said, I would like to breastfeed. And, you know, I got 6 months to do it. Baby's on the way. Can you help me? And these doctors said yes. And a pediatrician then followed up with this child to see how it was thriving or not based on taking the chemicals from this person's body. Now, this here I'm about to show you is presumably not the person in question. This is another breastfeeding biological male that went viral. Now, just look at this post saying, you know, in the end, I only breastfed my child for a few weeks. I then had to stop because I had a cancer relapse and didn't want to poison my child. Here's me on the bus on the way to the first round of chemo, like breastfeeding for the last time. Now, I get that your last nursing session is very emotional. I've done that 3 times. What they're saying is that presumably this person has been on heavy duty pharmaceuticals to make the male ducks produce milk. And then that person's body developed cancer or relapsed into cancer. And so that's why they stopped breastfeeding. It wouldn't, they weren't worried that maybe whatever brought back the cancer was a toxin that could hurt the baby, right? That's not a concern. Nobody here's worried about that, David?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like, saying that they didn't want to give them the cancer treatment drugs, but, like, is the whatever properties or chemicals they had to put into this person to produce milk, is it really milk? Like, you know what I mean? It's like, are the nutrients there? It seems like those are going to be just as bad of chemicals, potentially, as the cancer drugs.
We're going to get to that, to whatever it is that's coming out of the male ducts, because there is some comment on that and the fact that it's not really tested. We don't really know. But a lot of these cross-sex hormones have been associated with cancer. So you're not worried about being pumped full of hormones in order to turn your body into something it does not naturally look like. But you're then worried once the cancer starts because of radiation. That's not being a good parent. It's not. You know, what these men are doing are using something called the Neuman-Goldfarb protocol. It was originally developed to help biological women who adopted or had a child via surrogacy to breastfeed. Now, here's what it entails. Here's from the UK Hospital's Infant Feeding Network saying that what this is a combination of contraceptive hormones, physical stimulation through a breast pump, and domperidone, yes, medication to mimic the hormonal changes of pregnancy and birth. Now, they say that there's little evidence related to the success or safety of the protocol. We don't know. The impact of specific element or doses of the constituents milk produced. Lactation professionals report anecdotally that there is significant variability, with some people able to produce a large amount of milk and most able to produce a partial milk supply. In general, this chemical, I'm not able to say, domperidone, must be continued throughout the period of lactation, which is challenging because in the UK, it's only supposed to be used for nausea and vomiting at the lowest effective dose and for the shortest period of time due to reports of cardiac conduction side effects. So it has this known side effect, but you have to take it the whole time you're trying to produce milk if you're a biological male, but we know it's not very good for you. And again, there's no evidence around the safety or the composition of this milk. Does anyone care? Now, when you donate your breast milk, which I've looked into because for my daughters, especially, I had a lot of milk. Like one time this is probably TMI, but I'll tell the story anyway. I was going to buy a book in a children's bookstore and I went to hand over my credit card and I went like plink, plink on my wrist because it was just like everywhere. And the woman at the bookstore was like, what's happening here? Do we have a leak? It was me. It was just so much. Like, you can't stop it. And I realized that this is a great problem to have if you're a nursing mom. But so I looked into donating my milk, especially because my daughters would not take a bottle. Like, they would take their little fists and punch it. It was me or nothing. It didn't matter if I left the house. Nothing mattered. But you have to have your milk tested if you donate it to a milk bank for HIV, HPV, hepatitis, syphilis, tobacco, alcohol, among other things. You cannot donate milk that is not tested and give it to other babies unless you're a man, I guess. Go ahead, David.
Well, I was going to say, and the thing is, like, anything that you put in your body, it doesn't matter what it is, anything you put in your body at the time you're breastfeeding goes into that milk and in a concentrated form. So it's like, the baby's getting a concentrated form of whatever that is. And so if that drug has side effects for people, it's going to have the same side effects for the baby. And it's like, do you not understand that? Like, if they're like, hey, side effects may include this, 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 and this. Well, that transfers to the baby too. It's like, well, I think I could handle those side effects in order to get the feeling of breastfeeding my baby.
Yeah. You know, nursing moms, we're not supposed to have coffee because that could rile up your baby. Certain foods like broccoli make your baby gassy. You know, you're supposed to avoid all kinds of things. If you want to go on a contraceptive, there's a specific type of birth control pill you can be on because they don't want the hormones in the baby. I'm going to talk about that further in a second. So For biological moms, we have to be careful, and we want to, because nursing is important, but the baby is more important to biological moms. To people who are gender ideologues, the nursing is more important to validate their gender identity than the baby. And that to me is criminal. The case we're talking about today, not the person who had cancer, but this other person, it was supervised by doctors, but it wasn't even this man's baby. The man's partner, boyfriend or girlfriend, had the baby conceived, I think, with someone else. And then the trans-identified male decided to try to feed it as an exercise in womanhood. I presume because the partner may have been a biological woman who identified as male. And for those people, breastfeeding feels a little too feminine, and they just didn't want to. So again, not that they didn't try, or they didn't think they could, or they were worried about the hormones on the baby, but they didn't want to because it hurt their ideology. Okay. We may not be talking about the world's best parents here. So they're calling this an adopted child of the biological male who decided to breastfeed. Now, here's what the case report said, that this person was on cross-sex hormones for a total of 6 years. Here is all of the cocktails that they were taking. Look at estradiol. We're going to get back to that for a second. Apart from that, they said no main, risk factors, except, oh yeah, below. They said they had laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Thank you.
Cholecystectomy. Yes.
That is a minimally invasive surgical procedure used to for a diseased gallbladder. So we're not talking about an otherwise healthy person. This like, oh, otherwise they were fine. But they were on this major cocktail of cross-sex hormones to turn their body into something else and had a diseased gallbladder. But otherwise, yeah, go ahead. Let's see if you can feed a newborn baby. Again, the estradiol that we're talking about that they were taking to become a woman, is an estrogen steroid. Again, if you have a baby and you're nursing and you want to go on the birth control pill because you're not ready to have another baby, they don't put you on a pill that has estrogen. You have to go on a pill without estrogen. It's called progesterone only because they don't want you to pass that to the baby, and because estrogen actually reduces milk supply. And so you're messing with yourself, right? They do say that they lowered this person's estradiol in advance, in 2 weeks before the baby came, so that it wouldn't mess. Here's what they said. They went to a low dose patch of estradiol and progesterone was lowered as well. And then the baby was born 6 pounds, 13 ounces, and the patient breastfed exclusively for 6 weeks. That means that baby was not getting anything else. So this gives me a lot of anxiety as someone who knows that babies need to eat a lot in the first 6 weeks, and they were depending on a biological male. They did not supplement. During that time, the pediatrician reported that the child's growth, feeding, and bowel habits were developmentally appropriate. And then at 6 weeks, they began to give the baby formula. Thank goodness.
I have a question, too, that I don't know that they're like, are they only talking about the medications that were taken specifically for the breastfeeding and like leaving out a potential antidepressant or anxiety medication these people may have been on? Or do they, because I know a lot of those, if you're on them, you can't just get off of them and then go on other medications. You have to like wean yourself. So does the study talk about that at all? They just leave that out?
No, it's here. Okay. It says the medical history of this person had panic disorder, for which they were taking occasional clonazepam, and insomnia, for which they were taking Zolpidem. So yes, they were taking those things up until they decided to come up and try and switch themselves into breastfeeding person. That's a good point because yes, that was there. Now, in this case report, they point out that breastfeeding is best for baby for all of these reasons, which is true, immunological support, bonding, all of these things, and that formula-fed infants, have a higher risk of rotavirus and hospitalization for respiratory tract infection and SIDS and all of these things. So yes, that's true. But what this baby got was neither formula nor breast milk in its truest form, because breast milk is a conversation between mommy and baby. You know, the enzymes from the baby's saliva tell your body what to make and you respond accordingly. So it may have been getting some kind of chemical, but it's not necessarily what that baby needed. That doesn't, we don't know at all if this breastfed baby got any of those benefits, because we don't know anything about this type of fluid. Go ahead, David.
It's like Awa on Avatar. You know, you connect and it's like a real connection to your baby. And it's like, if you don't have all the elements, you're not really getting that.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Now, this man had complications too, because he was on androgen blockers, which is the hormone that men take to keep the male sex hormones at bay when they want to present as a woman. They have no idea how much of that got into the baby. And according to this write-up, they don't seem to really care. Here's where they mention the androgen blockers. And they say, you know, it has been reported to have tumorigenic potential in rats, so it can cause tumors. But according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, it's thought to be compatible with breastfeeding. Like, how do they know? Thought to be is not studied. They think maybe these androgen blockers, because what? Like, they're not sure, but they think it'd be fine. And then also they bring up the idea that domperidone, which we talked about earlier, is used only for stomach problems. Was it diarrhea or something like that? And you have to get it through Canada, because it's, there are strict rules where this person lived. So they have, it's a workaround. It's a workaround. This is medical experimentation on an infant.
Yeah, otherwise you'd have a bunch of little Luigis running around, little babies with big, thick black mustaches, probably.
I suppose, you know, we know from research about this type of inducing lactation on a male body that this milk has never been tested. I hesitate to even call it milk. No baby can consent to being tested on like this. I don't understand how doctors are like, sure, let's see what happens. We don't know how these hormones get into breast milk and how that would do on a brand new baby, but screw it. Let's give it a try.
I'm impressed they're even referring to it as breasts and breastfeeding. I'm surprised they're not saying chest and chest feeding.
Yeah. Yeah. And don't get me started on that. Right. I mean, they're breasts as much as, you know, any prosthesis, although it seems that this person didn't have any prosthetic breasts. One of my other major concerns about this is in the mommy communities, when you have a baby and you're not able to nurse, there are women who give it their damnedest and they just can't for whatever reason, no matter how hard they try. Those mommies put aside their need for validation as a new mommy, because they know that their stress about not making milk and the risk of their baby going hungry is not worth it to the baby. So they put themselves second in order to put the baby first. That's what a real mother does. What this person did is the opposite of motherhood. You don't say, oh, this will make me feel good, and tell everybody else that I'm a real woman, and it will signal something to the world. This person doing this to a baby, an unwitting baby, is not a mother or a father. It's a selfish person. And the doctors who went along with this, they should have thought of the baby first. I don't know what to say about this other than I'm horrified on behalf of the babies, and I'm horrified on behalf of moms who have nursed as much as I have, and for moms who wanted to and never could. So it makes me want to cry. David, do you have anything else to say about this?
Well, it just blows my mind that, like, you know, how much the pharmaceutical industry pushes this stuff, because they just make hella profits. Everything that these people are going through, the pharmaceutical industry is involved in the whole entire process. And so it just always leads me back to the money. And it's like, you people actually think that some of these places or some of these companies have their best interests in mind. It's like not caring about what's in that. Oh, we don't care if it's like going to, you know, the hormones or whatever. We're not going to look into it. It'll be fine, you know, because at the end of the day, the pharmaceutical companies are still making their money. And that's just what it feels like it's all about for me. Because if you really cared about that child, you would not put anything foreign into their body at all. You would want the purest form of nutrition for that baby from you know, the beginning of their life.
Yeah. Yeah. And those of us who've done that, who've been so careful about what we've eaten, who've always, you know, put the baby first, who've nursed until, you know, again, and, you know, a lot of it for nursing mommies, there's evidence that nursing prevents cancer, breast cancer in the mother. This again puts them in a separate category because, whatever that person was doing to themselves brought back on their cancer. I'm not saying that these are a directly related result, but we do know that a lot of those cross-sex hormones have correlation with cancers. You know, again, who cares about the baby, right? The baby then becomes a prop. Helen Joyce, the author of Trans Today, she posted that she wasn't even going to post the picture of the photo that I showed you in the beginning because she felt like the baby was an unwitting participant to someone's ideology and being used as a prop. And I agree with her. I showed it to you anyway for illustration of, you know, what is being out there. And I'm torn about having done so, but I did. I did that. And we're going to call it for this segment. So let us know what you think in the chat if this can be construed as anything other than medical experimentation on newborn babies. Okay, we're going to talk about the lawyer in the Assange case. This lawyer is suing the CIA and Mike Pompeo for spying on his conversation with his client, Julian Assange, and tapping into their electronics. Now, could this be the linchpin in the Julian Assange case, which is marching forward like the ants go marching in? We don't know, but our own redacted correspondent, Dan Cohen, spoke to this lawyer, and we're going to see what he has to say. But first, before we do that, I want to tell you about our show sponsor over at Lear. Now, it's no secret. If you're tuned in, you know the experts are predicting a recession heading our way. Layoffs are already happening, and the government is printing money, further devaluing the U.S. dollar. And in fact, today, the Wall Street Journal said that we are in a rich session, meaning even rich people are hurting, you guys. If we're in a rich session, you know it's bad. Well, last year please cue the violins. Last year was terrible for most investors. 2023 could be even worse. That is, unless you were smart and invested in gold, then you were protected from loss while other investments fell. If the experts are right and we do get hit with a recession, 2023 is looking even better for gold and silver investors. So if you are interested in investing in gold, then Lear will help you start purchasing precious metals or converting part of your IRA or 401k into a gold and silver IRA. So call Lear Capital today at 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com. Now, right now, if you buy 1 ounce of gold, Lear Capital is giving away a free ounce of silver. And that's incredible. Literally free silver. You can keep or you can sell it immediately. Do what you want. There are a lot of gold companies to choose from, and Lear Capital has over 25 years of experience, thousands of five-star reviews, and a risk-free guarantee that gives you 24 hours to review your purchase before committing to it. Lear Capital is a top choice when buying gold and silver. So again, call them, call Lear at 800-613-3557, or go to LearRedacted.com and get your free gold and silver investor guides and receive up to $15,000 in free bonus metals with a qualified purchase. One more time, that's 800-613-3557, or go to LearRedacted.com. Well, lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are suing the U.S. CIA and its former director, Mike Pompeo, for recording their conversations with Assange and copying data from their devices. Two journalists have also joined the case, and redacted correspondent Dan Cohen spoke with one of the lead lawyers recently, Richard Roth, and he's here to tell us about it.
Yeah, Natalie, so the extradition of Julian Assange from the UK to the United States is inching closer by the day, appears to be imminent after a prolonged legal battle, which has, of course, been brutal for Julian Assange himself as he languishes inside Belmarsh Prison. Now, at the same time, there's a parallel case where, as you said, well, there are lawyers and journalists who visited Assange when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, and they were spied upon by apparently the CIA through a contractor named David Morales, who is a former Spanish soldier who ran a security firm called UC Global. So Richard Roth is the lawyer representing this case against the CIA and former CIA director Mike Pompeo. So I spoke to him at length, so let's watch that interview. So Richard, you are the lead attorney representing two attorneys and two journalists who were spied upon while visiting Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And you have sued Mike Pompeo and the Central Intelligence Agency. Can you just first of all explain your case?
Sure. So as we, as has been reported and everyone is somewhat familiar with, Julian Assange has been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Well, he was there from, I think, 2012 to 2019, about 6 years. After that, he was literally physically taken out and now has been sitting in maximum security prison in London. And while he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, which he sought asylum and received it, he literally lived there for 6 years. So it was 6 years. So he had numerous people come visit him over the 6 years. You can imagine he had doctors, he had lawyers, he had journalists, he had friends, he had family members, all of whom came in to just their relationships with him. He couldn't go anywhere, so they came to him. We learned that during the term in 2017, we learned that, in fact, and this is all came from a Spanish proceeding, which I'll get to, that, in fact, anyone who came into the embassy, when they went in, they had to first hand the security there, their iPhones, their iPads, their laptops, the cameras, everything, and then they walked into the embassy. We learned that in around 2017, the CIA, crazy as it sounds, had a company called UC Global spy on Assange from 17 until he was out of the embassy. And what they did was they took those phones, laptops, iPhone, iPads, etc., and imaged them, and they went back to the CIA. So the first problem is these people that went in, two journalists and two Americans, went into the embassy with a right to privacy, not thinking anyone was going to take their electronic equipment and image it. Unbeknownst to them, everything was imaged. The second problem is that when they went in to speak to Assange, he, in that room, he had one main conference room, it was bugged. There were microphones and cameras in that room, unbeknownst to him. And the argument that we're making is that the federal government cannot actually, it's an invasion on your privacy. They can't take anything, look at anything without a search warrant. And by that, you need to have probable cause, go to a judge, the judge will issue a search warrant, and then they have a right to look at whatever they want. And what the CIA did in this instance was they didn't do anything. They just said, we want to see everything that anyone that comes in and out of Assange. So these four American citizens who have constitutional rights have sued the CIA and Pompeo because they have very strong reason to believe that, in fact, their rights were violated. Pompeo was sued in particular because when he first became the head of the CIA, he announced that Julian Assange was what he called a non-state hostile intelligence service, whatever the heck that means. And so he believed he had the unfettered right to do whatever he wanted with Assange. Assange wasn't a U.S. citizen, so do what you want with a non-U.S. citizen. But as far as U.S. citizens go, you can't just image their information and as well as take notes and have video and audio of the meetings. And that's essentially the basis of the argument.
So with the CIA spying on Assange and everyone visiting him, including his lawyers who presumably were devising his defense strategy, what does that mean for the U.S. government's case against Assange? That seems completely absurd.
Yeah, think about it. Not only does the CIA have all of the information that was imaged from the lawyers when they went in, and there's doctors for that matter, but they actually have the video and audio footage of Julian Assange sitting with his lawyer preparing a defense by a case brought by the CIA. So it is very problematic. If and when he comes to the U.S., and we believe he'll be extradited very soon, that'll be a motion that's going to be made before the federal court judge in Virginia. How can the CIA, how can Assange properly defend this case when the government not only make allegations against him, but knows what his defense is, they overheard conversations. So it'll become very messy in Virginia. But just to think that the government has that information, it's even worse than that. Because think about it. If Deborah Urbick and Barton Kunstler, both of whom are lawyers, walked into the embassy and handed their cell phone and their laptop was imaged, then the CIA has confidential communication between not only them and Assange, but them and their other clients. So if Ms. Urbick or Ms. Kunstler have a file with John Smith, the CIA has that file. And it's just totally inappropriate for the CIA to actually just image everything without getting any kind of authorization by a judge. So on many levels, it's very troublesome. It's also troublesome on the doctor-patient privilege. Doctors going to see Julian Assange, and in fact, the CIA has his medical information, which no one should have. But the most troubling thing, to your point, is that the government is suing Assange, and Assange, in preparing his defense, is being listened to by the same entity, the government, that's suing him. And that is very problematic. And what's going to happen is that will make its way to motion practice in the Virginia courts.
Yeah, I mean, if that, what would it say about a Virginia court if they actually pursue this? I mean, it seems like kind of, you know, getting into kangaroo court territory if they were actually to use that. I mean, is there a precedent for a court allowing that?
So there is, and what the CIA, first they're going to deny it, although we think we have their hands in a cookie jar, which we can get to, but what they'll do, what they generally do, is say, we will exclude all of that information and we will not use it at the trial. That doesn't really get Assange where he needs to be, because if the CIA doesn't use it but has it, if they're going to know his defense strategy, if they're going to know what witnesses he puts on, it's very problematic. So we'll see what happens. It is rare. It's happened before where a government agency will say, you know what, we have documents, we'll exclude them, but not on this level. I mean, what they've taken from Assange is essentially everything, from conversations to documents his lawyers have. So they really have, you know, if you remember back, New England Patriots were in trouble when they took the playbook of, I think it was the Jets. They really have Assange's playbook, which is totally inappropriate and really just, well, it's beyond aggressive.
So, Richard, it seems like your case just got a lot stronger with the latest revelations from El País. We learned last week that Spanish police had only turned over to the court that is prosecuting David Morales, the Spanish security consultant who spied on Assange, that they had only turned over part of the files on his computer, on his electronics, his hard drive. And that included more than 250 gigabytes that had not been seen before, including folders marked CIA. So what does that mean for this case going forward?
Oh, it's a very good point. To your point, when we first started this litigation, we believed that we had very concrete evidence that essentially linked the CIA to the security company UC Global, run by David Morales at the Ecuadorian embassy. We had it by way of affidavits from individuals who worked for UC Global, who essentially swore to the fact that they thought they were doing engaged in illegal conduct by providing information to the CIA. So we had a good basis to start this lawsuit. On top of that, recently, the El País, the Spanish newspaper, follows the Spanish proceeding every week, and they publish all the time on information they've learned. So on top of what we thought was a very good brick and mortar, we've learned that UC Global had in its possession, and the documents are recently turned over, to your point, files that say CIA on them, files that essentially link the CIA to UC Global. Now, ask yourself, scratching your head, if the CIA had nothing to do with the UC Global's surveillance, then why would UC Global have CIA files within its coffers? So we now know that there's clearly a link between the CIA and UC Global. And what's happening on a weekly basis is, through the discovery in the Spanish proceeding, we are learning a lot more about the CIA's nexus to this case. We've also learned from the memoir in Pompeo's book, how he doesn't admit it, but the timeline makes it very questionable how the CIA was not involved in it. So we're getting a lot more, and every week El País is doing a document dive, is learning information, and is publishing it. So we believe that between the El País articles and the Spanish proceedings, it'll really buttress, it'll strengthen our case. On the evidence. That being said, we still are faced with the obstacle. The current status is the government made a motion to dismiss. And as we all know, it's very hard to sue the U.S. government. They have doctrines of immunity, all kinds of sovereign immunity. So if we can get over those hurdles, the hurdles of being able to sue Pompeo and the CIA, then the next step will be discovery. And we will be seeking all this information from the Spanish proceedings, from El País, and from the defendants themselves, UC Global, as well as the CIA. So there's a lot that we have to learn. What we have thus far is very strong evidence the CIA was involved. The legal obstacles, the next obstacle we have to overcome to defeat the motion.
It seems strange, kind of suspicious, that the Spanish police only handed over part of Morales's electronics, the data on his electronics at first. And, you know, according to El País's reporting, they have a couple of Assange experts that they quote as saying they highlight the appearance of deleted folders with information, among which several are marked with the word hotel, which is the name that Morales used to refer to the embassy, to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was taking refuge and spied on. And they say there's an abysmal loss of files and folders. Is that strange or even legal for police to withhold that information?
Yeah, it's certainly strange, and it may very well be illegal. Remember, this is Spanish law, so I'm not an authority on that, but it's certainly just, I have a problem. I mean, we all have a problem just thinking about it. If the police are, if documents are ordered to be turned over and they aren't, I could raise a president who's about to go to court on Tuesday in Florida about not turning over documents you're required to turn over. So it's the same issue. And in fact, the Spanish police may very well be in trouble for what they've done. My concern is not that. My concern is, now that we have the information, what is it? What can we look through it? Can we see it? Can we actually determine what the relationship between, like you said, the hotel, the CIA? There's a lot of information out there. And we believe that through Pompeo, the CIA did engage UC Global and did get information from Pompeo, which we were talking about earlier, both the imaging of information when you walked in the embassy and then the recording of information when you met with Mr. Assange.
And so if the case reaches discovery, I mean, you're representing two attorneys and two journalists who met with Assange in the embassy. But of course, as you said, there are many, many people, from family members, journalists, other attorneys, all kinds of people who met with him and were obviously spied on. What kind of information do you think you might see if you reach discovery phase?
Yeah, so there are a lot of other people. Yeah, there's dozens and dozens of other people. What we have to do is we have to fit them within a time period, 2017 until he left. The ones earlier, we don't believe there was any kind of agreement with the CIA, as well as the fact that they have to be U.S. citizens, because if somebody from Spain goes to visit him, there's not the constitutional protection. So those are the two limitations. But we think through discovery, we're going to get that information. We believe we're going to get Deborah Urbeck's image computer. We're going to get Margaret Kunstler's image computer. We may even get Assange's criminal lawyer out in D.C., his information. So we think there's a lot to get. We are very confident that everyone that went in there was both imaged and recorded. And it's only a matter of time. Again, the legal obstacles they're surmountable, because it's hard to sue the CIA. But if we get that past that moment, the first thing we do is go to the Spanish courts and say, let us see it too. So we think that there's a lot of information that really will embarrass the CIA. Because let's think of the irony here. Julian Assange is essentially going to be extradited, and he's going to be tried for essentially wrongfully locating and disclosing information, which is exactly what the CIA is doing. They are wrongfully taking information from Assange. So there's a real irony here in what's going on. We hope that we hope for a lot of things. One is that we get that information. And two is that in the Assange case, this issue is front and center because it's just really inappropriate for a governmental agency to take all your information and then try you with it.
And so all of this comes as the UK recently rejected Assange's appeal against extradition to the United States. So as Assange is closer and closer to being sent to what few expect to be a fair trial in Virginia, the case against him is becoming more and more absurd. And UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has 2 months to decide on this extradition. So what would it mean for the UK to allow him to be extradited, given what we know at this point?
So it's very interesting because the politics are unfortunately into play. During the Trump era, there was a real an aggressive pull to bring him back to the U.S. I don't know if Biden knows what to do with him because on a lot of levels. Level number one is that if they don't prove that he was actually hacking computers, the NSA computers, Snowden's computer, Manning's computer, and that he was just an investigative reporter, then what do they have against him? And number two, which is even more problematic, is that it really puts a kibosh on the First Amendment. What it does is it sends a signal to any investigative reporter. If I have information which I got illegally, am I not to report it? Think about it. Think of how many times the New York Times, Fox News, CNN gets information. Think about Donald Trump. They got his tax returns. The New York Times did several page articles. They got it allegedly illegally. Should they not publish it? And what it does is it causes a chasm between the First Amendment and the investigative reporters. And I don't think when he comes here, I think there's going to be groundswell of support to say, wait a minute. If Mr. Assange literally got information and published it, where's the crime? And that's what's going to be happening in Virginia. It'll be it'll be interesting. It hasn't really peaked yet because he's not here. But you're right. To your point, within the next couple months, he will probably be, certainly by the fall, he'll be extradited to the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sends there's a chilling, I think, that this the prosecution of Assange creates, and seems obviously intentional that anyone who, you know, goes on WikiLeaks or comes across any information or is given information that the powers that be may not like is going to think twice. And it seems like the prosecution of Assange, that's really the goal here.
Well, it's scary. Think back to Woodward and Bernstein with the Watergate era. Think about how they were given information, which 50 years ago, I believe, they were given information, which they published in the Washington Post. The information probably should not have been provided to them, but were they to not publish it? Think about the chilling effect it'll have. We wouldn't have Watergate if they got in trouble for publishing information, which they got in their own right. And think about how many times every day you pick up the paper, whether it was the Trump administration, the Biden administration, when the press gets information, they are not only is it better to actually publish it, but they have an obligation. If there's something that happened historically, they have an obligation to tell the world. That's the whole conflict between the government and the press. And for the government to just put a kibosh on what the press can report, it is a very chilling effect. And it's scary. And it's very scary what would happen to this country if, in fact, the government can determine what the press reports.
We've seen very little political will to defend Assange from, there's been a little bit. I think Marjorie Taylor Greene has said something. I haven't heard much from any of the squad lately. But overall, there's almost no defense in kind of political circles of Assange. What do you attribute that to?
So I think the reason why there hasn't been a lot of a groundswell of support or either side for Assange is because it's not here. It's not present. He's been in London. He's been in London for years, both in the embassy and now in prison. So I don't think that groundswell has happened yet. But there's an irony here. There's an irony that Donald Trump is about to be arraigned for violation of the Espionage Act. And the Republicans, I think it was Rand Paul, said recently the Espionage Act should be abolished. So there's an irony here that the Republicans, who were really the ones that were going after Assange, are now in their own little pickle with this act. And so let's see what happens. I do believe that once it comes to Virginia, there's going to be a tremendous amount of attention paid to Assange. There was an article written by, I think, five of the leading world newspapers 2 months ago, including the New York Times, El País, and other papers, saying he should not be tried. So I think the reason why it hasn't really come to light yet, it hasn't really come to the surface, is because it really hasn't begun to happen. But once he gets extradited, which we think is soon, and once there's a federal court judge in Virginia who's overseeing his matter, that's when the press, I think, is going to really, people are going to really take notice of this case.
Thank you very much, Richard. I appreciate your time and your work.
Thank you for having me.
So I think we really can't overstate the significance of this case, because it shows that the CIA was spying on Assange and his lawyers that he was meeting with and others in order to build their case, for the U.S. government to build their case, which will soon be prosecuted here in the United States, not far away from where I am. So, I mean, if this case advances against Assange, as it apparently will, I think it'll be a really dark moment for the U.S. justice system and expose a level of fraud and sort of a kangaroo court how the U.S., how the Biden administration and the Trump administration before that is doing away with facades of democracy in order to punish Assange. So the deal is not done, of course. We're going to see what happens after this apparent extradition, but I think it's going to be a real battle for democratic norms, any semblance of democratic norms to be maintained here in the U.S.
Right. I mean, these laws were like, they're hanging on by a thread, but they were written for a reason. I was recently reading up on the sexual assault cases in Sweden and how those were totally bungled. And the women and Assange, both of their rights were totally disrespected in pursuit of this agenda. So we've seen governments sort of bend over backwards to reinterpret their laws, and laws that are just holding on by a thread. So this is something that, you know, we're supposed to be able to avoid in a democratic process, in a judicial society. But it's fascinating to watch. And so we appreciate you keeping us abreast on this one.
Thanks, Natalie.
That's going to do it for us here at Redacted for today. I will be back here tomorrow. You don't get Clayton again until the third week of July. You've still got me. He should be back a week from Monday if the aliens return him safely, and we'll keep you posted on that. So thank you again for joining me. Remember to like and subscribe to the channel and share it with your friends. Also check out the newsletter and all that we have to offer at redacted.inc. We really appreciate you being here. I'll see you tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great night. Have a happy holiday if you're celebrating. I hope you're safe and your family is safe. Okay, bye everyone. Enjoy.